this massive state with such a small population might have a bigger influence on the selection of the Republican nominee for the presidency than you might think.
Political intrigue at the state Republican convention. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, April 28th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Anchorage School District narrows the search for a new superintendent.
And Anchorage, as you well know, is a very diverse school district, and it's great to hear that, but so what?
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The weeks are counting down until the first salmon return home to Alaska rivers and streams. Alaska's people live lives that are deeply connected to salmon. Alaska's economy and families are fueled by these relationships. Learn more about Alaska's salmon at salmonlife.org. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
State Senate and House Conference Committee members today agreed to a legislation that would allow for 70% of excess earnings from the Power Cost Equalization Endowment Fund to be put to other uses. Of that percentage, any amount up to $30 million would go toward a community assistance program, funding that could be key to that program. Up to $25 million beyond that would go for renewable energy and bulk fuel programs and rural power system upgrades. Senator Lyman Hoffman said, as the remaining 30% of any excess earnings would revert to the endowment. The compromise legislation is subject to approval by the House and Senate. The state Republican convention started this afternoon in Fairbanks. We sent APRN reporter Liz Ruskin to check it out. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Lori.
So how's it going up there?
Well, it's pretty good. We're at the Westmark in Fairbanks. About 400 people are coming here from all over. And 160 of them now are vying to be a delegate to the national convention in Cleveland. There are only 25 slots to fill, so everybody knows it's really competitive, and they wonder whether they know the right people, whether they've been active enough to get noticed. One delegate wannabe I saw is carrying around copies of his resume on bright orange paper.
Wow, so lots of hopeful would-be delegates. What else is going on up there?
Boy, it's all about Cleveland, at least so far. The first event today was an orientation, and party chairman Peter Goldberg dropped a bombshell, or he hinted at a bombshell.
You mean about the national convention?
Right. Peter told everybody that there's a national TV crew here from Fox News, and he suggested they may be on to a real story. Here, let's play it.
I'm not going to tell you what Fox News is here for. It's going to be exciting. Suffice to say, Alaska, this massive state with such a small population, might have a bigger influence on the selection of the Republican nominee for the presidency than you might think. And the rest of the nation may find that out tomorrow.
So what is that all about?
Okay, so this is a room full of election nerds. So what passes for super exciting here, you know, may not be seat of the pants type stuff for normal people. But I think what he's talking about is adjusting the state party's rules for binding delegates to a particular candidate. You know, as a result of the presidential preference poll in March, the Republicans are sending 12 delegates for Senator Cruz, 11 for Donald Trump, and 5 for Rubio. Rubio asked to keep his delegates, even though he suspended his campaign. Now, according to existing state party rules, those delegates have no choice but to stay with their assigned candidate through at least 2 rounds of balloting in Cleveland. I think Peter Goldberg is saying that the state central committee here in Fairbanks is going to change those rules so that the Alaska delegation will be more influential. Or I think that's what he's proposing anyway.
All right. Liz, we will stay tuned and talk to you tomorrow to find out more.
I'll be here.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, former Senator Mike Gravel wants Bernie Sanders' attention.
I will be approaching Sanders shortly, asking him to look to the possibility of going forward with direct democracy.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
What can a tiny piece of dust do to you? It can stop you in your tracks. Studies show exposure to dust pollution can cause tightness in your chest, wheezing, and shortness of breath, even if you're healthy. When you're on an unpaved road, drive slowly, especially when operating an ATV. When hauling dirt, cover it up. Do your part, avoid dust, and clear the air. We'll all breathe easier. This message sponsored by Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation.
The 48,000 students in the Anchorage School District could have a new superintendent as early as next week. The district is unusually large for a city the size of Anchorage, with a sprawling array of needs that have made it difficult to find a superintendent. As Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports, a months-long search has yielded two candidates with very different experience across Alaska's schools.
Inside the auditorium at Bartlett High School, about 100 people listen as School Board President Cameron Perez-Verdia introduces candidates during a community meet and greet.
Without further ado, let's get started, and hopefully this will be fun.
Perez-Verdia asks the audience for their questions as he's explaining how the school board went from 84 applicants to just two finalists.
Both candidates are from Alaska. Both have extensive K-12 experience, and both have worked as superintendents.
First up is 46-year-old Dr. Dina Paramo, who came to Alaska in 1991 by way of Texas. Paramo has gone from a teacher in Glen Allen to the superintendent for the Mat-Su School District, earning higher ed degrees along the way. One of her daughters is an undergrad at UAA, and the other's a high school senior in Wasilla.
I'm quite familiar with many of your high schools. They beat us all the time.
During her opening remarks and about 40 minutes of questions, Paramo addresses general proposals for dealing with evolving technology and financial constraints. But she focuses more on her track record and approach to juggling the needs of teachers, legislators, families, and students.
I have a really great job, and I'm not leaving because anything is terribly wrong. I'm leaving for the best opportunity in the state. Anchorage is really the hub of Alaska, I see it, and it's a terrific opportunity. And so hence, I'm here before you today.
After Paramo leaves the stage, there's a short break before the next finalist comes up to the lonely podium facing the crowd. Dr. Steve Atwater is the interim dean at UAF School of Education and was in the running for this same superintendent job once before.
4 years ago, I went through the same process. So if you were there 4 years ago, there's a t-shirt in the back of the room for you.
Like Paramo, Atwater has been an educator in the state for a long time. But his career is a little more varied, having spent almost two decades in the bush before taking over as superintendent of the Kenai Peninsula Borough's school district. Those experiences, he says, inform how he'd like to see ASD better approach diversity and student achievement.
And Anchorage, as you well know, is a very diverse school district, and it's great to hear that, but so what? I think that's a great thing to talk about. But unless every one of those children are excelling and going to where they potentially can go, it doesn't mean anything.
Atwater spends a good chunk of his time during questions laying out a plan to recruit more teachers from Anchorage and rural Alaska. He also talks a lot about how technology might be used to adapt to fewer teachers in the classroom as state funding shrinks, emphasizing that such a restructuring is a long-term project.
I liken the Anchorage School District to one of these big container ships that's coming up Cook Inlet. That ship doesn't slow down outside Kincaid Park or Fire Island. It starts to slow down way outside Nikiski, okay, because it takes a long time. The district's the same way.
After the presentations are over, Perez-Verdia explains the school board is aiming for more community involvement in the hiring process than in the past. This time around, they set up an advisory group, surveyed families, and all day long have been bringing the finalists to different schools and community meetings.
School board members have been receiving literally hundreds of emails from students and from the public sharing their thoughts. And so all of that is a big part of this process, and it will make a difference in terms of our decision.
Asked whom he prefers, Perez-Verdia says he hasn't decided. But for some, the event made the choice obvious. Dina Mitchell has kids in ASD schools and is part of a statewide education advocacy group.
So I walked in really with an open mind, not knowing which candidate I was going to prefer. But the evening here was hugely, hugely illuminating for me personally.
So who would you pick?
You know, as a parent in the school district, I really thought that Dr. Atwater had wonderful, wonderful ideas, and I think that Dr. Atwater is absolutely right. Our system is not working anymore.
The school board will make their decision before the weekend, but not announce whether the candidate has accepted the offer until their Monday meeting. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
EPA Region 10 Administrator Dennis McLaren testified in front of a House Oversight Committee today. It was McLaren who decided to move forward with a Clean Water Act 404C determination in the Bristol Bay watershed following an ecological risk assessment done by the EPA. The House Committee has been investigating whether or not that was fair to Pebble Mine and proper for EPA. KDLG's Dave Benninger has more.
McLaren found himself in the hot seat for about 2 hours Thursday as the Republican majority members took turns airing grievances.
And Mr. McLaren, you've demonstrated a distinct lack of fairness and impartiality and sound administrative abilities. And you are exactly the type of federal employee or bureaucrat that Americans are really getting tired of.
Mr. McLaren, just to be honest, your agency appears to be more of a taxpayer-funded advocacy group than an impartial federal agency.
Your part of the agency is willing to pick and choose between the rules and pick and choose policies as they see fit at that moment. That's very frustrating.
Those were Republicans Brian Babin, Bruce Westerman, and Frank Lucas. Chairman Lamar Smith of Texas has made EPA a primary target for the committee's scrutiny and says the improperly handled decision about Pebble Mine is another example of larger overreach.
This committee should support due process, protect the permitting process, and insist that EPA actions be based on objective science. The EPA violated all of these tenets in its evaluation of the Pebble Mine.
Congresswoman Eddie Bernice Johnson, a Texas Democrat, offered a rebuttal. She laid out that the Clean Water Act does give EPA authority to put protections on waters before discharge permits have been applied for, though that's only been done once before. Johnson said this shouldn't be the political issue her colleagues on the right had made it into.
It is about protecting a unique environmental resource. In that regard, I find it ironic that EPA has been condemned in recent weeks for doing too little to protect the water in Flint, Michigan, and at the same time as they are being condemned by some of the same committee for doing too much to protect the water in Bristol Bay, Alaska.
Thursday's hearing, like the two that preceded it, did not deal with the merits of developing Pebble Mine. House members did, however, grill McLaren over a number of other by now familiar topics, like the legality or propriety of preemptive 404C action, collusion by EPA staff with outside anti-Pebble groups, working from a predetermined bias, the use of hypothetical mine scenarios, missing emails, and the adequacy of the Inspector General's report. It mostly boiled down to the P word, which was used a lot, including here by McLaren when asked if it would have been fine or perhaps even better to let NEPA play out like usual.
I think the NEPA process is a fine process. It is an excellent process, but there are other processes as well, and the 404C process is an independent process that has its own rules and due process, and it's a very fair and transparent process as well.
McLaren was asked repeatedly Thursday if he would consider revoking the 404C determination. He consistently answered that no, he would not.
Our proposed action in Bristol Bay is not a veto. It's not a final action. And the proposed determination does not prevent Pebble Limited Partnership from filing any permit applications.
This is the third hearing the House Science Committee has held regarding this topic. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
Former Alaska U.S. Senator Mike Gravel is in Alaska this week. The outspoken Democrat is known for being fiercely independent, famously reading the Pentagon Papers on the floor of the Senate in 1971 at a time when President Richard Nixon refused to release them to reporters. He also ran for president in 2008. Gravel is speaking tonight at the University of Alaska Anchorage about Alaska's place in the world and what he sees as a failure of representative government. He was elected to the U.S. Senate in 1969 and says everything that happened in the state in the decade of the 70s had national and global implications.
The discovery of oil, the adjudication of the native claims legislation, the environmental legislation with respect to ANILCA. All of that happened within that tenure, and I just happened to have been involved in the leadership capacity in all of the issues, both the plus and minus.
Senator Gravel, you've been described in the past as a maverick, as a radical. Do you feel that you are?
Rather than being radical or what have you, I'm visionary. I can look ahead and look too far ahead and then fight for that and realize that I've left my constituency way behind me and they don't understand what I'm doing. Here's a classic which affects Alaska. When I was in office, I reasoned and came to the conclusion that oil is going to be temporary. Whether it lasts 50 years, 100 years, it's still temporary. And so if you really want to look at down the road at what the future of Alaska should be from an economic point of view, you come away with a simple conclusion that what is it we have in abundance that will never go away? It's our beauty. Alaska is absolutely beautiful. And so it's no different than ladies of the night selling their beauty and retaining their beauty the next day. Well, Alaska's the same way. We could sell our beauty, and in so doing, we would have to build luxury activities so that people would come and see the beauty and enjoy it. Now, we have a summer tourist business. What I tried to do was to, which was obvious, which was to try to see if we couldn't expand our tourist activity into the winter. I tell people a lot of times, you want to see the beauty of Alaska, go in the summertime. But if you want to understand the Arctic, go there in the wintertime.
You jumped into the 2008 presidential race. What do you think about what's happening currently, the current contest in the country and the front runner candidates, both on the Democratic and the Republican side?
If it weren't for the fact that our political system is so corrupt, Bernie Sanders would walk away with this election. And I will be approaching Sanders shortly, asking him to look to the possibility of going forward with direct democracy, meaning that he can realize his revolution if the people have the power to make laws at the federal level. And I have the plan to do that. And so if I can sell him on that, then it won't matter who gets elected president of the United States. We'll be able to take our agenda that's so interested to all these people, take our agenda to the people directly. Now, you have an initiative process here in Alaska. I've used it when I was a senator. If it's okay for an Alaskan to vote to make laws in Alaska, What's so wrong with having Alaska being able to vote on laws at the federal level? Is there some magic where we become dumb when we move from the state to the federal level? Of course not. We don't have the power to do it at the federal level because the government won't let us do it. But Bernie has the troops in the field and the money to turn around and enact the National Citizens Initiative. And if the United States were to empower its citizens to make laws, that would go around the world like wildfire.
Former Alaska Senator Mike Gravel will be speaking at the University of Alaska Anchorage at 7 p.m. this evening.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
Alaska Pacific University is still accepting applications for its Early Honors Program. The Alaska Pacific University Early Honors Program satisfies high school graduation requirements while students earn college credits from a regionally accredited institution. Early Honors students gain these benefits and make the best use of their senior year of high school. More at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
In the Northwest Arctic, K-12 caribou hunting has been contentious for years. Alaska's largest herd continues to decline, ratcheting up tension between rural subsistence users and outside hunters. Last week, the Federal Subsistence Board voted to close the vast area to all but local caribou hunters. KNOM's Laura Craigle reports.
From Kotzebue to Kobuk and from the Chukchi Sea coast to the northern Seward Peninsula, Game Management Unit 23 covers thousands of acres of federal public lands. And earlier this year, the Northwest Arctic Subsistence Regional Advisory Council called on the Federal Subsistence Board to close them all to non-federally qualified caribou hunters. The council argued the closure was necessary to conserve the dwindling Western Arctic caribou herd and to stop outside interference with subsistence.
There's a long history of user conflicts in Unit 23.
Chris McKee is the Wildlife Division Chief at the Office of Subsistence Management.
We hear repeatedly from federal subsistence users, outside hunters camping on traditional hunting grounds, and a lot of other issues surrounding perceptions regarding, you know, wasting of meat and those kind of things. So it's something that we've heard about for many, many years.
His team of biologists is in charge of analyzing potential changes to federal wildlife regulations, and the board takes their analysis into consideration when approving or rejecting proposals.
But this is a case where the board actually went against our recommendation because OSM's recommendation was to oppose the closure.
That's because McKee and his biologists don't think the closure will help to conserve the herd. Hunters harvest about 13,000 caribou in Unit 23 each year, with local residents accounting for approximately 94% of the total take. McKee says that means outsiders only harvest about 600 animals on average.
So you're looking at 5% or less of the entire total harvest in the unit. So from a biological perspective, eliminating that 500 or 600 animal harvest is going to do nothing to change the trajectory of the herd.
Currently, biologists estimate the Western Arctic caribou herd to have about 200,000 animals. That's less than half the population of 10 or 15 years ago, and biologists aren't sure exactly what's caused the decline. But they say natural aging, decreased calf survival, and climate change are likely contributors. Meanwhile, McKee says some rural residents blame outside hunters for flying over the herd and changing its migration patterns. McKee says biologists aren't sure if that's true, but even if it were, he says closing federal lands would not stop the problem because people can still fly to hunt other species or go sightseeing. Still, the board voted 5-3 in favor of the closure because of support from the Regional Advisory Council and public testimony. In their analysis, OSM biologists wrote that at a February hearing in Kotzebue, the, quote, vast majority of those present were in support of the special request. McKee says another factor was that the board can only close Unit 23 to outsiders for one regulatory year. The council would have to propose another special action request to close it again next season.
I think that was another consideration that played in the board's mind, kind of like, well, let's see if it helps this one year and kind of reevaluate.
McKee says he's been fielding frustrated calls from outside hunters who have already booked their trips and are now out of luck. The closure will also bar caribou hunting by Alaskans from urban areas and rural Alaskans who have since moved away. The closure goes into effect July 1st and will last through June 30th of 2017. I'm Laura Craigle in Nome.
Haines and Klukwan subsistence fishermen saw disappointing hooligan runs last year, but this spring, things seem to have turned around. The hooligan returned in bountiful numbers to the Chilkoot and Chilkat rivers. KHNS's Emily Files has more from the shores of the Chilkat River.
To find out whether the hooligan are running, all you have to do is listen. The hooligan don't make any noise, but the thousands of gulls and other birds feeding on them do.
The seagulls are having a good time.
Oh, it's a party.
Sonny Williams trekked out to Jones Point Tuesday morning to pick up a bucket left behind by a friend.
Does anybody know if they saw a bucket down there with a net in it?
Williams says he's already caught his fill of fish from the Chilkoot River. But as we walk along the bank and he sees the black streaks in the water that show where the hooligan are, he just can't help himself. He goes to his truck to get a throw net and brings it back next to another fisherman, Vince Hotch.
You ready, Vince?
The net splashes into the water and he starts reeling it in. He dumps a net full of little silver wiggling fish into his bucket. And he can't stop laughing.
You said you weren't going to get any more, but it's just too tempting, huh?
Williams doesn't just catch, smoke, and make oil with the fish. He also keeps data on them. When the run starts, how long it lasts in the Chilkoot and Chilkat. He started doing that because no one else was.
Which is pretty awesome.
Yeah.
To see a giant run like this, you know, because that means 4 years from now probably, or, you know, there'll be another big run. I really can't say that because I don't know, because there's no study being, nobody studies it. Fish and Game doesn't study it. Nobody studied it. So I decided to keep track of it.
Yeah, they're such interesting fish, and they always keep you on your toes.
Meredith Pokart is with the Tokchinik Watershed Council. It's the only group that's formally studied the local hooligan run, and they only have about 6 years of data for the Chilkoot River and none for the Chilkat.
It's better than nothing, but it's not that long of a data set, and it's only one river.
Pokart says the purpose of their catch-and-release study on the Chilkoot is to get baseline data.
Hooligan are a little different than salmon because hooligan are not necessarily tied to one specific river. They don't go back to that same natal stream to spawn, necessarily.
That seems to be what happened last year. The hooligan run was super low on the Chilkoot, only about 300,000, according to Pokart. This year, it's up around 1.8 million. But in the Taya River up by Skagway last year, people said it was the biggest run they had ever seen. The theory is that some unknown environmental trigger caused the hooligan to go towards the Taya instead of the Chilkoot. Now, Skagway is going to start getting some numbers on the hooligan run in the Taya.
We're basically trying to get some baseline information about hooligan or hooligan, whichever you like to call them.
Jamie Belt is a biologist with the National Park Service in Skagway. NPS is starting a hooligan study there.
It's just a really good indicator species for us of how things are functioning in that ecosystem, so it's a really useful species to focus on.
Back at the Chilkat, Williams takes out some of the hooligan he caught a few days ago and smoked.
I usually try to have one a day.
He hopes next spring the mysterious little fish will swim back to the Chilkat and Chilkoot so he can stock up for another year. In Haines, I'm Emily Files.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. And you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Fairbanks, Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Laura Craigle in Nome, and Emily Files in Haines. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins lead to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline. Commercial, sport, subsistence, personal use. Some hear these labels and think conflict. The Salmon Project sees connections. Join 10,000 Alaskans whose lives are connected by Alaska's salmon. Visit salmonlife.org to experience the stories. And find the Salmon Project on Facebook to join the community. Salmon Life, Salmon Love. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.